Now, we were speaking last time about eight years of difficulty, and we saw how the Servetus affair put the opponents of Calvin in a very difficult position, in which they first took one side and then jumped to the opposite extreme. And the result of all this was that within the next 2 years in the election, Calvin's enemies completely lost out. And so we go on to capital J, Calvin's last years, 1555 to 64. And there was a complete change in the whole atmosphere in Geneva in these years from the previous one. So under this we put number one, the complete defeat of his opponents. During the previous 8 years, those who did not want Geneva to be a great Christian center had made it very difficult for Calvin. We saw some of the problems they raised for him. But by the end of this time, the great majority of the people of Geneva had decided that what Calvin wanted was what they wanted for their city. And so those who were fighting him by all sorts of means, direct and indirect, were now completely defeated, and a council was elected that was entirely at one with him. And from this time on, while Calvin never had any position in the civil government, he was simply the leading minister in the church, had no position in the civil government whatever, yet his influence was so highly regarded that he had tremendous weight in just about everything that happened these 9 years. Yes, sir? 1555 to 64. Number two, the acceptance of the refugees into citizenship. Calvin's victory was not achieved through the vote of the refugees because they had no vote. The old citizens of Geneva had refused to give them any right except just the right to exist. But now, now that Calvin's friends had control, the refugees from France who wished to stay in Geneva and become citizens of it were given full right of citizenship, and several hundred of them very soon became citizens of Geneva. And in 1559, Calvin himself became, for the first time, a citizen of Geneva. Number three, the academy. With all the activities that Calvin had been so active in during this time, one that had been very near his heart was the development of educational centers at Geneva for training men for Christian leadership. And he'd been constantly working in that direction. In addition to all his other activities, he had been teaching, selecting teachers, training others, taking a very great personal interest in the lives of those who were the students there. And this academy, as they called it, which was developed to such an extent that in 1559, they changed its name and considered it almost as if it was a new establishment in 1559. So actually, it was simply an enlargement and development of the educational work that Calvin had already been doing. It exerted a great influence all over Europe from this time on, an influence somewhat similar to what the University of Wittenberg had exerted in Luther's early days, although it went in its outreach far beyond what that had done. Number four, Calvin's worldwide influence. We noticed that Calvin wrote hundreds of letters to people all over Europe, discussing all sorts of problems with them, writing on his own initiative whenever he would hear of a leader who he felt might be one for the evangelical cause. And he was consulted by Christian leaders in every part of Europe. And so this was not only through his letters, but through the men who had studied with him. He had a tremendous influence. During the years 1553 to 1558, you don't need to bother with those particular dates right now. We'll look at them later, more in detail, when we look at the history of the Reformation in England. But during those 5 years, which, as you see, come half of them during Calvin's difficult years and half during these last years when he was so dominant in Geneva, during that time, there were hundreds of refugees from England who had fled to the continent on account of the persecution of Queen Mary. And while those of the English Protestant leaders who did not flee were mostly burned at the stake, he burned about 400 Protestants at the stake during the last three of the 5 years of her reign. Many others had fled, and of those who fled, perhaps half or two-thirds came to Geneva. And they studied with Calvin. One of them was John Knox. who had been very active in the Reformation in England before. When, after Mary's death, the refugees returned to England. John Knox himself returned to Scotland, so he had been away from it for a long time, having been active in England for quite a while before English had to flee to Geneva and other parts of the continent. And their influence was tremendous in those countries. We will look at many details of Calvin's worldwide influence later on. Now, number five is Calvin's death. Calvin was only 55 years of age when he died. But his small frame, his rather weak body, had been worn out by the tremendous exertion of his life and also the tremendous strains at which he had gone. And for some months it was evident that his life was approaching its end. But he was very, very active, constantly preaching just as long as he was able to stand up to do it. And after he was confined to his bed, still dictating letters and discussing problems and making plans for Geneva and for the progress of Christianity throughout Europe. And the day before he died, the leaders of the Council of Geneva all came to his home and there had their farewell with him, expressed their thanks to him for all that he had meant for the city and their determination to carry on along the lines that he had laid out. And Calvin was indeed fortunate in having a young man named Theodore Beza, a man of high rank and fine training in France, who had been working with him for some time before his death in Geneva, and who took over the leadership there and continued it for another 40 years along the same lines as Calvin had been doing. But when Calvin saw how much adulation these people were giving to him, how interested they were in his opinion on everything, he became a bit frightened. And so after the members of the council left, he called two of his closest friends into his room with him. And he said to them, he said, "The way these people are treating me," and he said, "the tremendous regard they're paying to my ideas now, so different from their attitude, or the attitude of the leaders in the city, rather, a few years ago," he said, "it just makes me fear that they might try to make a saint of me or some sort of a great object almost of worship after my death." And so he said, "I want to do everything possible to prevent anything like that happening." And so he made these two men promise him that as soon as he died, they would take his body and go out to a certain field which he designated and would quietly, secretly bury him there so that nobody would know where he had been buried for fear that people might make his burial a place of pilgrimage and in some way give him the sort of honors that were being given to the medieval saints. And so that was done. And it was about 100 years later, somebody selected a point in the field which they thought perhaps was where Calvin was buried, and they put up a monument there. And the place is today one of the big cemeteries in Geneva, and when I was there in 1950 and again in 1962, a large group of Christians went to the place and put flowers on the place, and I don't think there was a danger, this being so long after Calvin's death, that he feared might occur. But whether it was the right place, nobody knows. But they were showing their respect to the great work that this man had done. Now we're going to look at some of the strong points and also some of the criticisms of Calvin. We're going to discuss them. And this matter of Servetus we discussed last time. We gave the facts. We're going to discuss it a bit more in detail. But that is not the next thing in our outline. We are first going to look at capital K, the effect in France of Calvin's work. The effect in France of Calvin's work. We hear a great deal about Calvin's theology. We hear a certain amount about Calvin's commentary and his letters. But a phase of Calvin's activity that is much less spoken of and yet was very dear to his heart was the missionary work for which he was responsible. He was greatly interested in his homeland of France. He had been there as a young man where he had been converted and where he had first met with other Protestants, and he had many of his closest friends had been burned at the stake for their faith. He had barely escaped himself from France. He was not content simply to be safe in Geneva to carry on Bible study and teaching. He wanted to do what he could for France. And so he, in the first place, thought to it that there would be a welcome for the missionaries, for the refugees. And the people of Geneva were glad to welcome them, to give them food and shelter, but when it came to giving them a safe home and opportunity to share in the benefits of the city, Calvin had a hard struggle getting them to agree to that. So eventually they did. But Calvin was anxious that these people should not merely escape from France, but that they should study the Bible, become thoroughly rooted, and then go back to win France for the Lord. And so he began training people for this purpose. And very soon, out of the refugees who came, a substantial number, after a long period of study, began to go back into France and to face the dangers there. So under K, number one is the return of the missionaries. The return of the missionaries. These men went back after receiving this training, and as far as possible, they kept up correspondence with Calvin, asking advice in problems before them, and he was tremendously interested in their progress in reaching people in France for the gospel. And now we have one of the greatest stories of progress of the gospel in all history, is the events of the next 30 years in France, after Calvin began his great work in Geneva. I'll call it number two, spread of the gospel. The spread of the gospel. The widespread, the great spread that occurred during Calvin's lifetime and during the first few years after. I'll just briefly mention to you the kings of France during this period, because their attitude toward the gospel affected greatly the possibility of spreading the message of salvation there in France. First, there was Francis I, whom we have mentioned two or three times before, and you've read about him in your readings in Daubigny. Francis I had rather a long reign as King of France, but he was a man who was personally not particularly interested in religion. His sister, as you know, Margaret, was one who was greatly interested and one who gave protection to the reformers as far as she could. And the early beginning of the spread of the gospel in France was not interfered with as much as it might have been, because Margaret was intervening for them several times. But Francis himself, when he found that placard on the door of his bedchamber that was attacking the mass in such violent language, and heard that similar placards had been distributed throughout Paris, he became very incensed, and he began a very strong persecution of the Protestant church. And all of Francis' reign was characterized by periods of great persecution, with many of them burned at the stake, and periods of laxity in which he just didn't feel like bothering about. And so you would have officials in some parts of France who would be very very severe in the persecution, and others who would follow the king's lead and would carry on the persecution to some extent during the periods when the king was violent, but would rather forget it during the periods when France didn't show much interest. And so up until 1547, during this period of about 15 years after Calvin's conversion, during this period, you have a situation in a way like that of the early Roman Empire. That is to say, a situation in which you have violent persecution, which cuts down on the leadership of the Christians, and which threatens the movement with complete destruction. But this persecution, causing the mass of the people to see the constancy and the bravery and the courage of those who suffer for their faith, and then before the persecution completely roots it out, it's being stopped. And there's opportunity then for the people who had been greatly impressed by the courage and the faith of those who had suffered, then to begin to take an interest. And consequently, during these periods of comparative cessation of persecution, the Protestant movement grew rather rapidly. And so by the time of Francis' death in 1547, there were sizable groups of Protestants meeting in just about every section of France. Maybe a third of the men who had studied under Calvin had been burned at the stake for their faith, but half to two-thirds of them had managed to elude the persecutors, had held meetings in private homes here and there and gone about, and had developed these Christian groups in many parts of France. Then Francis I was followed by his son Henry II. And Henry II reigned 12 years, from 1547 to 1559. And Henry II was much more ardent against Protestantism than his father. He carried on the persecution much more severely than his father had done. But Henry II was hampered in the persecution by the fact that these are the years, you remember, when Charles V had gained complete control of Germany. And Henry, much as he hated persecution, was still more afraid of the increasing influence of the Emperor, Charles V. And so he made secret alliances with the Protestants in Germany. And it was partly through his help that they were able to gain their freedom from Charles V and to get that peace that gave them tolerance to Protestantism in Germany. So Henry was doing this for political reasons on the one hand, while on the other hand, for his strong religious feeling, he was persecuting much more steadily and much more severely than his father had. Now, if in the providence of God, Henry II had continued to reign until as great an age as his father had reached, Protestantism might conceivably have been completely wiped out of France. But in 1559, one day, Henry II, who was very proud of his ability as a knight in the tournament, asked the leader of his guard, a Scotchman named Montgomery, to meet him in the lists, to have the two come toward each other, charging on their horses and then with their spears, and try to unhorse the other one. And Montgomery said, "No," he said, "you are the king," he said, "I'm here to protect you. I don't want to fight with you." Well, Henry wanted to show that he was as good a knight as anybody, as able a knight as anyone, and so that he could do this, and so he insisted. And so when he insisted, Montgomery got on his horse, and Henry on his, and the two came toward each other, and a thing happened that happened probably not once in a thousand times. The spear of Montgomery, instead of hitting against the iron of Henry's armor and possibly knocking him out from the horse, knocking him on the ground, or at least giving him a considerable shock, and maybe Montgomery would have been the one knocked down. But instead of that happening, it went right into the little tiny hole in his helmet, right into his eye, and pierced his brain. And so the king lay on the ground there, dying. And the people around wanted to tear Montgomery limb from limb for having killed their king. But Henry did perhaps the best thing he ever did in his life. He declared with his last breath, "I insisted that Montgomery meet me here in the list. It certainly is not his fault that it came out this way." But in the providence of God, an event which happens once in a thousand times brought the finish to this active persecution by Henry II. And as I say, if it had continued another 20 years, probably Protestantism would have been completely wiped out of France. But under Francis I, despite his vigorous intervals of persecution, it had secured a very good start. And Henry II, 12 years of persecution, had not cut it down a great deal. By this time, there were new missionaries coming all the time, and there were considerable groups here and there in France, which would hide the missionaries and pass them on from one group to another. Well, when Henry died, he left three sons and a daughter, and the oldest son was 15 years of age. And so young Francis II became king in 1559. And at the age of 15, he would not have been a great personal force in deciding what was going to happen, But it so happened that his wife, his young wife, was related to a family of very ardent Romanists known as the Guise family, G-U-I-S-E. One leader in just about every generation for some time, the oldest son in this family had been the Duke of Guise. His younger brother would be the Cardinal of Lorraine. And they had been gradually increasing in influence in France, and now they were the close relatives of the little boy who was ruling. And the and they were very, very bitterly against the Protestants. And so it looked as if the persecution would continue just as it had been before. The Duke of Guise seized 30 Protestants and hung them up on gibbets and took the young king and his young wife out to see them and to try to condition him for the carrying on of that sort of thing. But after Francis II had reigned 17 months, he got an infection in his ear, which probably a mastoid, I don't know what, but anyway, an infection in the ear, which caused his death. And he was succeeded by his young brother, who was then only 9. And when Calvin heard of it, Calvin said, the God who caused the stroke to the eye of the father caused a similar one to the ear of the son, in order that the progress of the gospel should not be stopped in France. And as a matter of fact, it made a complete change in France that the little boy of 9 was now under the complete direction of his mother, Catherine de Medici. And Catherine de Medici, queen mother now, was really in control in France. And although she she was there because Pope Clement VII, her Medici relative, had worked out the marriage for her with Henry II when she was quite a young girl, she was interested hardly in religion at all. She was interested in politics and interested in power. And she realized how great the Protestant force was, and she was anxious to maintain a balance and to get her own power, and she didn't care greatly about trying to stop it. Yes? Which came? Which
came?
Oh, the new one. I hadn't given that yet. I had not yet given Charles IX. But I had been talking about his brother, Francis II. Yeah. But now, under Charles IX, who was king from 1560 to 1574, Catherine de Medici tried to decide what would advance her own power best, and she never was able to reach a complete conclusion. Yes? M-E-D-I-C-I. M-E-D-I-C-I. She was a foreigner, she was from Italy, she was not at all popular in France, but she had the power. The power was in her son, Charles IX, and she was the queen mother, she was the real ruler. Under Francis, he had no power, her son, 15, because his uncles were really controlling everything. And under her husband, she had absolutely no power, Henry II. He'd been married to her as part of a political deal. He had no interest in her at all. She was just entirely on the side during his reign. But now she was in complete power. And the result was that it was more like in the time of Francis I again. That is to say, there were some intervals of persecution, but then at other times she would be trying to win the favor of the Protestant group and to use them as over against the other. But by this time, Protestantism had grown to be a tremendous force in France. In southern France, in one place, they held a great celebration in one of the towns of the on the anniversary of one of the saints, and they had some archbishops and other leaders in to hold this great ceremony, and they had more people in the actual participants in the ceremony than the visitors, the people who came to see it. There were only about a dozen people came to the great cathedral to see it, while 3 blocks down the street there were 5,000 Protestants meeting in an open field, with a man trained under Calvin giving them a biblical message. In Paris one evening, in one of the big parks, A little boy began to sing one of Calvin's songs. And he began to sing the psalm, and somebody else hearing it joined in, and somebody else joined in, and someone else joined in, and they say there were 3,000 people singing this psalm in a few months. And thus, in every part of France, there were Protestant groups now, who had been reached by these men who had been trained under Calvin, and had gone about in the land, risking their lives, many of them losing them, but who had thus reached so many people, and they organized them into churches. And here in France, you find Calvin's idea of church organization better than in Geneva. Because in Geneva, he had to work against the established situation and gradually change it. But he never could make it be what he wanted. The civil government always had considerable control over the church. But here in France, the church was an institution which, according to the civil government this time, had no right to exist. And so organization they developed was not interfered with by the state. If it interfered with them at all, it would be to destroy them. And so the result was that they had these churches organized with their ministers, and often one minister might work in several churches, but he would have elders in each church who would have the responsibility for the church. And these men would send representatives to a group over a larger area, and they would meet and discuss the problems of that area as a whole, and then they would send representatives to a group over a whole province, and they in turn would send representatives to a meeting for the whole of the country. And thus, each church had individual, complete freedom in ways, planning ways to advance its development, in ways to reach out and to win the lost, but they were in constant communication, helping one another and giving advice and cooperation. And you had an organization all through France which had grown up despite the persecution and which was now a very considerable force in France. On the other hand, by this time, the Jesuit order had become established. Now, we will look at the Jesuit order in some detail as we go on and look at the period of the Counter-Reformation. But the Jesuit order, which began after the Reformation began, was an organization which came to be devoted to a very great extent to the destruction of Protestantism. And, in fact, it did wipe Protestantism out of Poland, where a third of the people were Protestant at one time. It succeeded in winning back great parts of Germany and of other countries. And now, in France, the Jesuit leaders were coming in and were working very skillfully, and they organized a Catholic League with representatives all over France. And poor Catherine de Medici, wanting to have everybody under her, found the Catholic League determined to destroy the Protestant churches, and the Protestant churches determined not to be destroyed, and she tried to bring them together, get them to work together, and then she would sometimes favor one and sometimes she would favor the other. And in the midst of this, the Protestant movement kept growing quite considerably for a time. But then in 1560, the Duke of Guise, just about the time of France's second death, the Duke of Guise, his uncle, came into a town where they were having a Protestant meeting, and the Duke of Guise was very much disturbed in his heart because he had gone to Germany to help the German Protestants, which he hated doing. Now he was coming back and he wanted to get to feeling better about doing what he thought he shouldn't have been doing, but what politically he had to do. And he came to a place where a group of 300 Protestants were meeting in a hall, and they were singing hymns rather loudly, and he sent a man in and told them to quiet down. They were disturbing him. And they said, "What right have you got to tell us to quiet down? We have a right to sing the praise of God." And they went on singing. So then he took his soldiers and rushed in there and killed the whole 300 of them. And it was known as the Massacre of Vassy. And it began a series of what are spoken of as the Huguenot Wars. And during the next period of about 40 years, you have one after another war in France. with the Catholic League on the one hand trying to wipe out the Protestants, and you have the Huguenots, as they call them, trying to defend themselves. Now, this word Huguenot, it would be good for you to remember if you don't know it already. It's H-U-G-U-E-N-O-T, Huguenot. The word Huguenot is a word to describe the French Protestants. It was applied, we don't know who applied it to them first, but they came to apply it to themselves, to call themselves the Huguenot, but nobody knows what the word Huguenot comes from. The Encyclopedia Britannica says that there was a wall dedicated to a place dedicated to a saint, an old Saint Hugo or King Hugo, I don't know if they're sure who it could have been, but that at this place at night, some of the Protestants used to hold services, and so other people call them the followers of Hugo or the Huguenots. Now that's one theory. Another theory is that it comes from a German word, Eidgenossen, which means associates, and that they were called by this German word and that the French misunderstood it and called it Huguenot. I think either theory is quite improbable, but as to what the real origin of it is, nobody knows. But the word came to be a word used for the French Protestants, if you call them Huguenots. Now I have here a book, The Age of the Reformation, written by Professor Preser Smith, who has a very fine gathering together of facts about this period. It is a very fine gathering of a great many facts, but every now and then you find his strong hatred of supernaturalist Christianity coming out in various terms and expressions. And so it's he certainly was not prejudiced in favor of the Huguenots. But it's interesting to see what he says about it. He says, whatever the origin of the name, the picture of the Huguenot is familiar to us. Of all the fine types of French manhood, that of the Huguenot is one of the finest. Gallic gaiety is tempered with earnestness. Intrepidity is strengthened with a new moral fiber like that of steel. Except in the case of a few great lords who joined the party without serious conviction, the high standard of the Huguenot morals was recognized even by their enemies. In an age of profligacy, the men of the religion, as they call themselves, walked the paths of rectitude and sobriety. He is very, very critical of Calvin and Calvin's theology, everything about him, and yet he says, at another place in the book, it is very strange that with this awful teaching of Calvin, yet that his followers would have been such remarkably fine people and would have shown such remarkable character. But the Huguenots now had to fight for their lives in a long series of wars, but it was a period which was not a steady attack like Henry II's time at all. Because the Queen Mother would throw in with one way and then the other. And one time, when she decided to try to bring the two together, she arranged a marriage between the leader of the Huguenots and her young daughter. And the marriage was planned, and the Huguenot leaders were talked to how we would all get together for the good of France, and the great bulk of the Huguenot leaders were gathered in Paris. And just at this time, Queen Catherine decided that, after all, the two forces never would work harmoniously together, and the Catholic force was really the stronger, she decided, and she'd better throw her weight with that one instead of the other one. And so she talked to her son, Charles IX, who was still a young boy and not in good health, and he was very fond of Admiral Coligny, one of the great Protestant leaders. And she persuaded him to give his consent to the murder of Coligny and of his associates. And she got Charles to give his consent. They kept the plan secret until they had all these Protestants there in France, in Paris largely, the leaders. And then on the night of August 24, 1572, which was St. Bartholomew's Eve, on that night, they broke into Coligny's house and seized him and threw him out the window. And the Duke of Guise thrust his spear through his body, put his foot on his head, and declared his victory over him. And then they tore about from one place to another, finding the Protestant leaders and killing them. They say there were about 20,000 massacred in Paris that night, and there were similar massacres in other parts of France during the next few days. When word of this reached Pope Gregory, he had a special medal struck called the Smiting of the Huguenots in honor of the victory over the Huguenots. People today like to forget about that medal. It may, of course, be a fact that when he heard first of it, he only heard of the great victory and didn't hear the details. Because very soon, most of the leaders of Europe were horror-stricken at this duplicity and this murder and this great massacre. And most books today try to put the whole blame of it on Catherine de' Medici and to excuse others for having even been pleased with it. But it did strike a terrible blow to Protestantism in that its finest leaders were massacred that night. And so some writers say that though Protestantism succeeded tremendously in the next few years, that the best leaders were gone, and those who succeeded did not have the wisdom of the previous one. Whether that's so or not would, of course, be hard to judge. But people were amazed that within 3 years after the massacre of St. Bartholomew in Paris and all over France, there seemed to be more Protestants than ever before. And they had periods of peace and periods of fighting, and the thing dragged on. Charles IX, who had given his permission in 1572 for this massacre, died in 1574, died in delirium, calling out that he saw the blood flowing from Coligny and the others who had been killed in the massacre. His younger brother, Henry III, who had been made king of Poland on condition that he would promise not to do anything to hurt Protestantism in any way, because that was the Polish attitude at that time before the Jesuits managed to win back Poland. He was king of Poland, he'd been for a very brief time, but when he heard of his brother's death, he slipped away quietly in disguise and got out of the country and went back to France, where he was made king of France. And he reigned from 1574 to 1589, but he was pretty much a weakling and a degenerate, and his mother still was the real power. And during this time, the wars went on. So we call number three the Huguenot Wars, but we won't linger over them further than what we've already said. To go into the details on them would take a great long time. But we will look at number four, Henry of Navarre. Number four, Henry of Navarre. Navarre was a kingdom which originally was on both sides of the Pyrenees, partly in Spain, partly in France. And this kingdom, the Spaniards had seized the Spanish part, so that for some time now it had only been the French part, the Kingdom of Navarre. But Margaret, the sister of Francis I, had married the King of Navarre, and thus became the Queen of Navarre. And her daughter, who was a very ardent Protestant, succeeded her as Queen of Navarre. Now her son, that is the grandson of Margaret, the sister of Francis I, was Henry. And Henry was a very charming fellow, a very able soldier, a man who was looked to as the natural head of the Huguenots. All his friends and relatives were Protestant leaders, and now that Henry, the family of Catherine de' Medici had died out, except for Henry III, who was the king and a degenerate and had no children of his own, the next one in line to be king would be Henry of Navarre, who was the leader politically of the Protestants. And when Catherine fell out with the Romanist leaders, and she and Henry III fled from them to the camp of Henry IV. And then one of the men under the influence of the Jesuits got into the camp and got near the King Henry III and stabbed him to death. So now Henry IV was the man who was entitled to be the king of France according to the laws of heredity. And he was the leader of the Protestants. And many parts of France immediately welcomed him as king, but by this time the Jesuits were stirring up the others that they could not have a Protestant as king. And so from 1589, for the next 3 or 4 years, he won many victories and soon had most of France in his control. But Paris, by this time, the Jesuits had succeeded in raising the people of Paris to such fanaticism that under no condition would they have a Protestant, receive a Protestant for king. And so the armies, the Huguenots, together with those others who felt that they should follow the one who, according to the laws of the land, was their rightful king, were besieging France for a long time, besieging Paris. And the people got to, they were living on very, very little. They were on starvation rations, but they held out. And Henry said, what is France without Paris? How can you be king without having Paris? And he said, why should these wars have gone on for 40 years go on forever? He said, Paris is worth a mass. He said, I will become a Romanist. And then he said, I can give peace to my Huguenot brothers, give them toleration, give them freedom. And so he announced he was going to become a Romanist. And when he made the announcement, one of the priests in Paris, in his service, said, he said, my dog went to mass this morning, so I'm going to make him king of France. And the attitude was, here's a man who becomes a Romanist in order to be king. That's no sincerity for that. But the Jesuit said, you must take the man at his word. He says he wants to become a Romanist, you must take him at his word. And they succeeded in persuading the others to do it. The only condition was the Jesuit should have the bringing up of his children, and they should be the leaders in the court. And so Henry IV became a Romanist, and Paris opened its gates to him. All of France was under him. Everybody was happy that the long series of wars was over. And in 1598, he made a law of toleration. Number 5, the Edict of Nantes. The Edict of Nantes. N-A-N-T-E-S. Now, this edict, which he made in 1598, declared, this edict is permanent, it's perpetual, it can never be abolished. It declares that the Huguenots have complete liberty of religion in France. They are not allowed to hold services in Paris or in any city to which the king may move his capital for a time, but otherwise they are at liberty to have services anywhere they want in France. They are at liberty to have their churches without being interfered with. They are at liberty to have positions in the government. They are not to be interfered with on account of their religion. And so he gave this edict. He even said in it that the Protestants, from a few Protestant cities which were quite strongly Protestant in the south of France, were to be allowed to have their own garrison and their own protection to be sure they would never be interfered. And so it appeared that a great step forward had been made for Protestantism in France. That's number 5, the Edict of Nantes. But number 6, a half century of comparative toleration. A half century of comparative toleration. There were those who were never happy about this, who insisted such an edict should never have been made. They said it gives the Protestants right to worship in their churches, but it doesn't say anything about building new churches. So they mustn't build any new churches except what there were before this time. Well, they kept on building new churches for about 20 years, and then the others succeeded in getting the government to follow that practice. They couldn't build any new churches, but they could use their old ones. Cardinal Richelieu, who was the real ruler of France during the reign of Henry IV's son, Cardinal Richelieu, for political reasons, worked with the Protestants of Germany. But in France, he claimed to give toleration, but he said, why should they have armies of their own? Why should they have garrisons? And give up your garrisons. Be under the protection of the government. You're guaranteed freedom of religion forever. Why do you need individual protection like this? Why others don't have their own armies. Why should you have them? And many of the Protestant cities gave up their garrisons, but one city in southern France refused, and he went against it with an army. He seized it for some months. Finally conquered it, but then he took away its garrison, knocked down its walls, but did not interfere with its freedom of religion. So we have number 6, did I say, a half century of comparative toleration. But during that half century, Cardinal Richelieu and his successor, Cardinal Mazarin, managed very gradually to cut down the power of defending themselves. And also they gave various Protestants opportunities to go ahead in the government in positions where they could make a lot of money and get a lot of fame, but not have a great deal of power, and where they would perhaps become obsessed with the things of this world and take the leadership away from the church, take their leadership into the world. And so some say that during this half century, there was comparatively little growth in the church. Perhaps a third of France had been Protestant at the beginning of the Huguenot War. Those wars had cut down Protestantism quite a bit, but still it was very strong at the time of the Edict of Nantes. Well, during this half century, there was a large and strong church which had its own schools and had its had a great influence in Europe, but it did not grow as much as you might have wished that it would. And then number seven is Louis XIV. Louis XIV was the grandson of Henry IV. His children were brought up by the Jesuits, and so were the grandchildren. And when Louis XIV was 5 years old, his father, Louis XIII, died. And so he became king at the age of five, 1643. He reigned to 1715. But being brought up from the age of five as king, and considering that everything was his to do with as he wanted to, there was no restraint on him. And while he was a very able young man, in fact, when Cardinal Mazarin died and they came to him and said, "Who shall we go to as head of the government?" He said, "The state, that's me. L'état, c'est moi," he said. "I am the governor." And he did much more than most kings had of taking an interest in every part of it. But he was constantly carrying on wars for the aggrandizement of France, and particularly of himself. But in between them, he lived an extremely licentious and wicked life. And yes? He was murdered by a man trained by the Jesuits in 1610. He became king nominally in 1589, the death of Henry III. Well, Louis XIV heard the Jesuit preachers in his court preaching against sin, declaring the wickedness of licentious living and how those who do it will be in hell forever, in terrible torment. And he got so he couldn't sleep nights. He was in misery over it. And so he went to the, and he said, "What am I going to do? I'm accustomed to this licentious living all my life. I don't know any way I can get over it. And yet you say I'll die in hell forever for it." "Oh," they said, "there's no need of your dying in hell." "Well," he says, "why not?" "Well," they said, "because you can recompense for it. You can do good deeds that will more than overcome it." He said, "What should I do?" "Why," they said, "you could put an end to Protestantism." And so Louis XIV began taking away the privileges of the Protestants, and gradually he began moving in such a way that the people whose belief wasn't very deep began to give up their religion and began to become Roman. And then when there were still a great many who were absolutely solid in their belief, he forbade them to hold church meetings other than just their regular services. He forbid them to have any meetings covering France or the province of France. And then in the various sections, he would send an army in, and he would put the soldiers on. He would order people to take the soldier into their house and give them quarters. And the soldiers, licentious, rough soldiers, were given to understand that any rough way they treated these Protestant families, nothing would be done to them about it. It made it very disagreeable. And once they would turn Romanist, then the soldiers would be moved to some other house. And he did everything like this he could for a time. And then in 1685, he announced he was revoking the Edict of Nantes. It was now illegal to have any worship but Romanists in his whole country. All Protestant pastors are given a period of a certain length of time, I think about 2 months, in which they can leave the country, but no others are to be allowed to leave the country. However, despite his order, 400,000 people managed to escape from the country. 400,000 escaped, and the Huguenots became many. There were thousands of Huguenots went to England, to Holland, or to Germany. Even as late as the First World War, they were holding their services in French right through the war in Berlin. And these Huguenots were, many of them, the very finest people, the best class of able, industrious French people. But 400,000 escaped, and they've been a great influence in many parts of the world ever since. Those who did not were imprisoned or fled into the mountains and lived in caves and managed to carry on their
their religious life to some extent there, and all historians agree that a tremendous detriment was done to France by its losing the larger part of its very finest people. But for the next, from 1685 then, for a period of 100 years, it was absolutely illegal to have any Protestant services in France. The young people were brought up with never having an opportunity to even hear the Protestant sermon. Then you had the terrible excesses of the French Revolution. And today, France is said to be perhaps the hardest place in the world to do Christian work. There's an atmosphere of indifference, but it's largely an attitude of atheism. There is a small group of very ardent Romanists in France, but the great bulk of the people seem to be atheistic rather than Romanistically oriented. But this great number was either driven out or killed. And thus, the work of Calvin in France had as great an effectiveness and a success as any missionary work in history it had for a period of years. And then, when Henry Ford said, Paris is worth a mass, he said, I can compromise a little with what I believe, and thus can help all of my associates. Well, they did have half a century of fair measure of tolerance, but eventually Protestantism was almost completely wiped out of France. Well, we'll continue there the next Wednesday.